Why is it? Okay. I do that every time.
Ooh.
Ooh. Oh my God. You sound like Pennywise. Who I just recently rewatched the second It chapter 2 again, and I love how much Pennywise sounds like Pooh Bear. Like Winnie the Pooh.
So comforting.
Ooh. Ooh. Ooh, the wind blew the whole circus away. Anyways.
I love how he bounces back and forth from like, ooh, to Georgie.
Georgie. We're going to do that movie one of these days.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. It's so good. But I do like that scene in the beginning where he's like, they're both laughing, right? They're doing the whole like, pop, pop, pop. And they're like, oh. And then all of a sudden he just kind of like turns down. He's just like, like he's playing along for the longest time. And then he starts to like get hungry almost. Just yeah. Be like, okay, I can't play the game anymore.
Yeah. He's like, your food.
Anyways, hey, how's it going?
Hi.
I'm Karina.
I'm Clark.
And what the fuck is our podcast name again? Ah, welcome to It's Always Spooky.
I'm so glad that you actually remembered to do the intro this time, because last time we got like 10 minutes in.
Growth.
Yeah.
It's Always Spooky.
So, this week we're going to cover, honestly, probably one of the better found footage style movies that has come out in the last like decade.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I've seen quite a few found footage horror movies at this point, and I definitely, this one got a lot of good scares. This one, honestly, it holds a really special place in my heart because all of the killing and stuff happens on my birthday.
Oh, cute.
And it's one that they like actually title in the beginning, like what date everything happens. And I'm like, hey, that's my birthday.
We love birthday murder.
Yeah. Which, speaking of which, that's why obviously we don't tell you what dates we're recording any of these episodes, but we've been on a bit of a hiatus because birthdays happened and then like other things happened.
So. Backpacking trips that tried to kill me.
Yes. All sorts of good, fun life events that we will get into. So finally, we're back in the hot seat.
Yeah.
Doing it again, recording again. Probably going to take a minute to like grease the wheels and get going.
Yeah. And I think really the only kind of behind the scenes info that I'll give out is that the podcast, which by this point, the first episode will already be released. But the only one that I know the date we're recording it and the date that it's released is we're recording the episode for the movie Halloween and releasing it on Halloween. So yeah. That's going to be our actual like debut episode.
Yeah. It's going to be awesome. Yeah. Which I think will be real. It'll be very poignant. We're going to record it the week before and then release it on Halloween. So it'll work really well. But back to the topic on hand, because we kind of briefly brought it up. We were talking about found footage. We're going to be doing 2015's Hell House LLC.
Yeah, which is now like a series.
It is. I think I had written it down in our trivia, which we'll go over later, but there are quite a few sequels at this point, and there is another one coming too.
Ooh, that's exciting, because I feel like I've watched probably three from the franchise at this point. I want to say three, and I don't feel like they've gotten worse. Like, I think they still all individually hold up pretty well.
I will be honest with you. I haven't seen the sequels. And I, over the last few days that I've been watching the first one, have seen the sequels on YouTube because they're all available. They're all available on Shudder, I think on Netflix and on YouTube right now. But I have not actually seen them. So I don't know like how the quality goes up or down, how the story changes. Sometimes I'm always kind of hesitant with sequels because I feel like you end up leaving a lot of things left to the imagination in the first one, and then the sequels try and answer all of those questions, and sometimes that doesn't land the way you want it to land.
Yeah, sometimes the way that our minds interpret things and kind of the way that we run with it kind of feels better than the way that they end up doing it.
Yeah.
That tends to ring true with, I feel like, a lot of sequels.
With most, I mean, yeah. The only thing I can't think of is, well, this isn't a sequel, but where you're left with an ambiguous ending would be like The Mist.
Yeah.
Right? In the book, it was very ambiguous. In the movie, it was very concrete.
Yeah. Yeah, which I was actually editing that episode
Oh, really?
Like 2 days ago. Yeah, and I got everything like polished up and I saved it. And in Logic, when you export something to like actually upload it, it's called bouncing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I like got the bounce done and I was waiting and I'm like, put it in the finished folder. It's all done. And then I got completely done exporting it. It was like, fuck, I didn't put the intro music in it. So
so I got to do the whole thing again.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's a 10-minute like, export that I got to do one more time. So I did actually write out a synopsis for this. I don't know how much I like it, but I did write one out. A haunted house attraction production company acquires a new location for their seasonal haunt, an abandoned hotel in the small town of Abaddon, which local lore suggests may be haunted. After a suspected malfunction at the attraction causes the death of 15 attendants and staff, mystery surrounds what truly happened on that deadly night. 5 years later, a documentary film crew investigates the details of that night, but the answers they seek may come with a bit more than they bargained for.
Ooh.
Blah, blah, blah.
Blah, blah. I like that. I mean, mine will be much shorter. It would literally be like a small group of... not haunt enthusiasts, but like haunt attraction engineers. And they're creating a new haunt in a new kind of small podunk town in an abandoned hotel. And during their opening night, all, what for lack of a better term, all hell breaks loose. And it's actually set 5 years after that event. And it's about a small documentary team that are doing like a story about the Abaddon Hotel and the haunt and like what happened. Yeah. And they're like talking to people who were at the haunt and they end up meeting somebody who was actually like not only there, but helped create the attraction.
Kind of diving right into it. One of the things that I really like for the setup of this film is I do tend to appreciate like mockumentary type films.
Yeah.
And this is a good mix of mockumentary and found footage. Mm-hmm. And those do a lot of the time go hand in hand, but they can also exist independently of one another. And I got both with this and it made me really excited when I first watched it, which I think I watched it for the first time like 2 or 3 years ago. And it's been at least yearly watch since.
Yeah. No, yeah. I really enjoy it. Every time it shows up like on that free part of YouTube, I almost always just put it on in the background because I like listening to it. It does have some good, genuine, scary moments and is just, it's very entertaining from start to finish. Like it does kind of intrigue you throughout.
Yeah.
And gives you some good twists and turns in it too. I'd say there's only a couple of things in it that I really dislike or just didn't really feel hit as well as they could have.
Yeah. Yeah. And I will say, even just from today's experience watching it, because medication's not doing its thing and the ADHD is front and center today, it still kept me in it for like the good majority of it. I was watching it like between sets while I was lifting. I was watching it as I was closing up shop at the cafe today.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't find myself getting distracted too much. Which unmedicated or not functionally medicated Clark, that's a pretty big deal. I don't even watch movies well normally.
Yeah.
So so kudos to them.
Yeah. And it isn't, like we were saying earlier, it's not like the pinnacle of found footage films. It does have its flaws. But that being said, even though it is very cheaply made, it was on a smaller budget, it has some very genuinely good moments that I'm excited for us to like dive into and talk about.
Yeah.
Should we get here? I wonder if we should get started with, I had put down, you know, I don't actually remember what the title card is for this. I don't even really think there is one because it is kind of given more as like a mockumentary style, but I did want to put in the tagline, which is New York's Scariest Haunted House Tour.
Ah, I love that it's labeled as like New York's Scariest Haunted House Tour because it's supposed to take place in, I believe it's a fictional town of Abaddon, New York, which is supposed to be upstate. And it's filmed in Pennsylvania.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Wait, I might have known that. That's interesting though.
Yeah.
Do you want to go straight into our favorite or scariest scene?
I think while we're on the topic of like just the town itself.
Yeah.
I do want to point out one little bit of like, I guess, fun fact that I discovered along the way, which was that Abaddon itself is, in the movie, it's explained as the original owner of the hotel decided to purchase it because of the name of the city. Because Abaddon has a few different meanings throughout mm-hmm. history. It has a meaning within the Hebrew Bible. It has meaning within Greek mythology. It also has meaning a little bit more contemporary mm-hmm. than those two sources. But one of the ones that seems to be the most applicable to this situation is Abaddon is supposed to be the guardian of the underworld. Mm-hmm. And so they think that they are essentially purchasing a hotel to be able to do a bunch of fuck shit, apparently.
Yeah, wasn't it that the owner purchased the hotel for like a cult?
Yeah.
For like cult reasons?
Yeah, okay. for culty fuck shit. Mm-hmm. And then they're like, oh, well, we're going to do it here because this is the gate to hell.
Yeah, and I was going to say that even kind of makes sense too, why the original owner would have purchased it for that reason if he wanted his cult to create an opening to hell itself. It's almost maybe comical isn't the right word, but comical is the word that comes to my mind, that's where you would have it, because Abaddon is the guardian over the gate of hell.
Yeah, and you know, if only they would have known that the gate to hell is in Sunnydale. Anybody who's watched Buffy knows that.
I did not watch Buffy, but
I've watched it too many times.
Grew up on it.
Yeah. Yeah. It, like, if you throw a Buffy or a Charmed scene at me, I got it.
Yeah.
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 But yeah, let's just drop on into, I guess, favorite scenes.
I'm glad that you brought that up, though, because I remember a lot of the scenes in, like, the early documentary part of it where they're asking, like, the different scholars and stuff about what they were thinking that was going on, and I had kind of glossed over it in my brain when it came to recapping it, so I'm glad you brought it up. What would be your scariest scene?
I was having a really hard time with this.
I did too. I felt like I kind of copped out a little bit, but
I kind of feel like I did too, and it's because today at least I was watching it on my phone, and while I'm trying to analyze it and be like, what is the scariest scene, while I'm under really bright fluorescent lights looking at it on a 6-inch screen,
right,
and you know, there's like a bunch of people around and everything, it just doesn't have quite the same effect.
You're not in the atmosphere.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. I'm not high as hell sitting in my dark room with a giant TV and having the full effect. But I think for me, the scariest and favorite scene might be the same.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. So I wrote down two favorite scenes, and I'll leave the one that is tied to the scariest scene for the second.
Okay.
But my two favorite scenes are when they very first notice that like things have gone awry, or they start noticing that maybe things in the hotel aren't really what they expected it to be.
Sure.
There's a scene where they go into what looks like a dining room, or at least a setup for a dining situation, mm-hmm. and nothing's really happening in there. They're just kind of checking to be like, yeah, everything's normal, nothing's going on. And then they leave for a second, turn around and look after the grandfather clock dings, mm-hmm. and then like all of the candles are lit, it looks like there's actually like a scene there for like a haunted dining situation. And that actually, the first time I watched it, I remember it spooking me a little bit, right. And I think it was mostly because of the grandfather clock sound,
like, right.
The audio engineering with this is really good. So that one kind of got me for a second, and I think it's kind of the build up to that scene, and that's kind of the release of all of that tension.
Right.
The second one, which is also probably a favorite scene, is the little sheet peekaboo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The bed sheet peekaboo.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The bed sheet peekaboo. Because is it Sarah that is in the room?
Well, that's who Paul assumes that it is, but you don't actually see who it is. It looks like a woman.
Yeah.
But it's just a figure that's hanging out in his room.
Yeah.
And it hangs out in his room, like, comes in while he's talking that first night.
Yeah.
To back up a little bit, I even wondered to myself, I'm like, if they're taking all of this footage just so that they can have something to watch later, what the fuck is this little video diary that Paul's making for himself where he's talking about Sarah and, like, Sarah's boyfriend Alex not sharing her and stuff like that. Like, I was just like, why the fuck are you gonna watch this back? Is this productive for you, for your haunt?
Yeah.
Are you hoping that Alex sees this? Like, I just But anyways, like I do. I agree with you.
I think that you're supposed to assume that it's Sarah, and it does actually show her face, and it shows fairly close up.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of stuff happening on her face at that point.
I'd have to go back and look at it, because I remember the first time, if I'm thinking about it correctly, the first time that you see Paul and he's talking to the camera, and then he kind of like gets a spidey sense and he turns around and there's someone standing there. I don't think you see who it is. He recognizes her. Because he does. He says like, oh, Sarah, what's up? And then she doesn't say anything. He's like, oh, are you sleepwalking? So like, even though we don't see it, he obviously recognized her.
Yeah.
Or just like assumed it was her because like degrees of separation was just like, well, it can't be any of the guys, you know?
Yeah. There's obviously like long hair going on. Right. That sort of thing. And then it's the second time that he sees her.
Yeah.
Where she's just kind of like sitting at the edge of the bed. And then he like doesn't see her for a second.
Yeah.
And then he like turns and sees her and he's like, oh fuck. And then like gets under the blanket really quick and then lifts it up and she's a little closer.
And that's what
and then lifts it up again. She's a little closer.
And I wonder, like, I might have to watch it again because I remember this is when Paul dies technically, when this, whatever this apparition is that's spooking him. And I don't know if that's Sarah. I think it's just a spirit that's haunting him.
Yeah.
And he just thinks it's Sarah for the longest time. But
I
also listed that as my scariest scene. And because it was hard, I'm sure it's just because we don't really have souls anymore when it comes to scary things. We're pretty desensitized. But that was really the only thing that, like, even though I knew it was going to happen, it still got my butt to pucker a little bit.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. And there are several scenes throughout this movie where there is a very prominent clown who is terrifying in and of himself, but I don't think they necessarily use him to like his full capability as far as really having that like horrific effect.
Yeah.
He's mostly just there to like build tension.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
I 100% agree. I thought that he would have been utilized more and would have been given more like animation when it came to his scares, but I was very happy with how subtle his performance was, I guess, if you could call it that.
Yeah.
Because, yeah. And just the way that they kind of used him, like you were saying, to literally just like build that intensity. Nice job, Echo.
Yeah, because people really like to use and abuse clowns. Like, they know that that's a common fear and they really like to just like play off of that as much as they can. And
I'm laughing because she just threw her toy past you and now she's just looking at it like, oh.
Oh, so this is mine.
Yeah.
This is mine.
I guess so.
Also, y'all might hear some doggy ASMR.
Yeah.
But, you know.
My dumbass dog, Echo.
We're pet owners, so.
Yep. You got to deal with it.
Yeah, it's on you. Yep. You can listen or not. I don't care.
I don't care. Good job, Echo. She's like, yeah, get the duck.
Yeah, I'm glad that they didn't, like, hammer in the clown shit.
Yeah.
The most terrifying things in this movie I honestly feel like are just the regular people.
Yeah No, I agree with you. Well, we both kind of did our scariest scenes just right off the bat there because they were kind of the same. Mine was also Paul's death with that like whole peekaboo scene. Do you want me to start with my favorite scene?
Yeah.
So my favorite scene is after this whole thing with Paul happens with the bed sheet. And it's pretty close to opening night. It's only like a couple of days. And they're doing some like final testing. And they're looking for Paul. They're like, where'd Paul go? And they hear the piano playing in the basement.
Yeah.
And it's playing the same tune that I'm pretty sure Paul was playing days beforehand.
With the creepy guy next to him.
Yeah. And it's just playing it over and over and over. It's like the same like little eight note tune. And so they think initially, I think it's Mac and Tony, they're like, oh, he's just fucking with us, right? And so they're running throughout the house, right? They don't see him anywhere. And as they're running towards where they know the piano is, it starts to kind of pick up, right? It starts to skip a little bit and you think like, oh, they're gonna run in and like, how's Paul gonna get out of the way fast enough, right? But they run in and there's nobody by the piano. And it even does like a little like like when they're standing in the room and they get they're initially just like super pissed off and they end up, I think it's like why it's my favorite scene personally is because you hear this piano, they're running through, they're looking, they're like running past all of these props and shit that aren't doing anything. And then right before they get into the room with the piano, it stops.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that's why it's my favorite, is it kind of, it builds a lot of tension there. And then that tension's kind of doesn't go anywhere for a moment.
I also love when the like, the item that is causing the terror is also the backing music. Like, yeah, they didn't need any other audio engineering to build the tension there, because the thing that was scary was
the piano. That. Yes.
Yeah.
I 100% agree with you. Yeah. And I think what I like about that scene too is that after they discover the piano, Paul's not there, they're just continuing to get more and more angry. Okay, like, where the fuck is he? Right. And they're running around. And I think I might be getting my scenes mixed up, because I remember at one point, doesn't somebody get like trapped in a room?
Yes.
Who is it that does?
I don't remember who it is, like, but which person are you thinking is about the scene where there's the strobe?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he thinks there's somebody else in there with him. And then they go and they like show the scenes later. I think I'm getting those two scenes, kind of like those wires crossed.
There are a lot of scenes that happen in the same settings with the same people. So it does get a little confusing.
Like kind of repetitive.
Yeah.
But anyways, that's my favorite scene. I just like that piano scene where they're looking, they're convinced it's Paul. They get almost all the way there and then the piano just cuts out. And then, you know, they kind of have to go from there.
I think I would say initially I had a different, I had the peekaboo scene as my favorite and my scariest. But I think if I'm going to actually choose an independent favorite scene, I'm going to do one that I had in my honorable mentions.
Yeah.
Which is, it's after they all wake up in the middle of the night, which I can't remember who it is who says, like, we all woke up at the same time. And he's like, well, no, you woke me up.
Yeah.
And then they start to go down the stairs to the basement. And he's like, we're going to fucking die on these stairs.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, that little bit of like comic relief, but also foreshadowing.
Yep.
I'm like, this, that was actually a very well done scene.
That's actually really good. I didn't realize that little detail. I got another detail for you. Towards the beginning of the film, when the documentary crew are talking to Sarah, mm-hmm. and they're like, where have you been all of this time? And she's like, and she said, I'm in a better place now.
Yeah.
Right. And it's just like that phrase of words was so specific that I remember the first time I watched this, I was like, that wasn't a throwaway line.
No.
She said that for a very specific reason, right?
Yeah. Like, that's right around the same time that they ask her, like, well, how did you get all of this footage? And she's like, well, I got to it first.
Yeah, I got there first.
And it's just like a... And later on, when you see her die,
yeah,
and it's like, oh, that's how you got to it first. Yeah.
Yeah. I really liked that ending scene though. Like when she's, we're getting off topic a little bit, but it's fine. When
that's what we do.
Yeah. That's the whole point, right? When she's being interviewed by the documentary crew later on and she's like, I'm really tired, you know, could we meet at my hotel later? And she gives him the room number and I'm like, that room number doesn't exist.
No.
Like I can like guarantee you. And and so I did like that they included that little detail. And when they go and they finally find her, she's sitting in the room in the Abaddon Hotel in that room.
Yeah.
And her face, she's not facing you for the longest time. And they're like, Sarah, like, what's going on? And when she turns around, her face is all fucked up. And I appreciated that. I was like, all right, fuck yeah.
Yeah. There is a lot of just like kind of cliche found footage horror movie moments in this film, but then there are moments like that that are so well done and that tie this whole story together that I think did make it so remarkable.
Absolutely. And even if it's something that I can see coming a mile away, whether that's just having a good like movie knowledge or not, I can still appreciate it as like a good detail to include in there.
Yeah.
And something that like, I didn't notice the significance of that line the first time I watched it. I just knew that it was significant.
Yeah. Right?
Like that she didn't say that just like off the cuff or at random. Mm-mm. And some people might've been able to predict like, oh, she's saying that because what do you say about dead people? They're in a better place now.
Yeah.
Right? So
I am curious, because and I might splice this over to the beginning and I might just cut it out completely, but we had talked about kind of like found footage horror movies as a whole, and how this isn't necessarily like the pinnacle of found footage horror. What do you consider the pinnacle?
The pinnacle?
Yeah, because to me, I can think of like what I think is like the beginning and was probably one of the best found footage horror movies for a long time, which would be Blair Witch.
Sure.
But when I try to think of a pinnacle, it's hard to say because there are quite a few hallmarks. Like there's Blair Witch. There is, I guess, technically Paranormal Activity is
found footage. I would assume so. Yeah. Anything that's done like with a first person camera viewpoint, yeah, I would assume is like a found footage film.
There's also, I'm going to look up the name of it really quick because I believe it was in another language. Antrim.
Antrim.
Yeah, it's called The Deadliest Film Ever Made. It's a found footage horror movie. Mm-hmm. And there are certain spots where it's like if you pause and you go frame by frame, there's like sigils that pop up and like shit like that.
Yeah.
They were saying that like people were watching it in the theater and then they would like go insane.
Yeah.
And like that sort of stuff.
I did hear that. I did hear rumors about that film. To answer your question, the pinnacle of found footage film for me, if I just think about like quality and providing genuine terror and things like that, I would probably think of like Cloverfield.
Oh, yeah.
Or Quarantine.
Yeah.
Yeah, those would be the two that like I would think of that I'm like, oh, that shit is fucking scary.
Yeah.
And is also well done too. Like a lot of people really don't like found footage because it's so disorienting and you don't really get a lot of detail because of kind of like that's the name of the game. Mm-hmm. So I'm always trying to think of things that like kind of break the genre a little bit.
As Above, So Below.
As Above, So Below is another really good one. It's a bit campy.
It is a bit campy.
It's really good.
Yeah.
It's definitely, we should cover that one. I literally just watched that movie like not even a week ago.
There's a lot in the genre that we definitely need to explore.
That's why we're going to be in business forever.
Absolutely. Because like there's also the VHS movies.
I almost mentioned VHS, but I felt like VHS was too anthology.
Yeah.
It was too like short. Like they're all very much like a found footage film, but that was definitely in my brain when I was thinking of.
And all the Possession movies.
Yeah.
The Taking of Deborah Logan, The Possession of Emily Rose.
Oh yeah. What's another good one? The Autopsy of Jane Doe.
I actually haven't watched that.
I don't know
and
if that's
I
considered
hear it's
a found
actually
footage.
Like
it's fucking good.
Pretty fucked.
It's really yeah. good. It's very like you expect to be watching one movie and you very quickly start watching a completely different movie.
Ooh,
like
that's
a
exciting.
Very different movie.
Yeah. We'll need to add that to the list like quick.
Definitely.
Yeah. So I guess we've gone through favorites, we've gone through scariest. Do we want to do trivia and then do ratings after?
So some trivia that I have for you, I could look it up. I didn't write down a bunch of trivia because I just figured I'd pull up the IMDb page, but I did write down, you were correct. There are currently three sequels with another one currently, I think it's in production, set to release in 2025. There's Hell House LLC, The Abaddon Hotel, Hell House LLC Origins, The Carmichael Manor. I think, is Origins the third one or is that the... So there's 2, 3 Origins, and then there's another one that's coming out, I'm pretty sure. I'm going to look up the trivia real quick and see if I can find anything that looks cool. Oh, I did read this, but I had forgotten it. There is a scene where one of the characters, Paul, runs out of the strobe light room and vomits. This was real and not scripted.
Oh.
The actor actually threw up on camera for real.
Nice.
The film was shot at a real haunted house attraction in Tuwamasing, Pennsylvania, called The Haunting at Waldorf Hotel. This haunt did take over an abandoned hotel just like in the movie.
I'm so excited for the one person who lives in Pennsylvania to be like, you pronounced that wrong.
I know. Tuwamasing. How do you say it?
Fuck, I don't know. I would say the same thing. And I would also challenge Pennsylvania person to try to say any of the city names in Oregon.
Or any of the city names in Washington.
Or the river names.
Yeah, right. That's it.
Look at the next city south of Eugene and tell me what the name of that is. Because if you say Goshen, you're wrong.
You're inaccurate. The eye trick Joey does in the movie is his actual eye, meaning he has it between his fingers. Also, he warns others not to try it. Disgusting.
Don't want to.
That's so gross.
Yeah, you don't got to tell me not to. I don't really care to caress my eyeball.
Yeah, no shit. The abandoned hotel does not exist in real life, but was filmed at the Waldorf Hotel. They spelled that differently. Tawamensen, Pennsylvania, run by Angie Moyer, who served as the film set's designer. It's located in the parking lot of the County Junction General Store.
Hmm.
Interesting.
Very.
Oh my God.
One day I'm going to learn how to say this.
Yeah. The tune played on the piano at various times in all four films is the old Meow Mix cat food jingle.
It is. How did my two brain cells not connect?
I didn't realize that either.
Wow. That song is in my dreams regularly.
No, you know, now I just have my Bonnie Lies Over the Ocean from As Above, So Below stuck in my head. And now I can't think of the tune that's in Hell House.
Ooh, As Above, So Below would be a good projector in the dark room movie.
Well, that's what we just did. Like, we watched it on the projector at our house.
Nice.
The main clown's outfit is the same as the one worn by the main clown in the found footage mockumentary film Behind the Sightings. So that's kind of interesting. It's like the same clown was in two different movies.
He's a star.
Star. I did know the answer to this question. On the car ride to the hotel in the beginning of the movie, Paul asks Sarah to answer a trivia question about a post-apocalyptic New York set movie starring Will Smith.
Yeah, doesn't she say, I can't remember what movie it is that she says, but it's Hitch. Like a romance movie.
Yeah, it's yeah. Hitch. She's like, Hitch is such a good movie. So yeah. Do you know what the answer is?
Wasn't it iRobot?
No.
It wasn't?
No. It's not post-apocalyptic.
Is iRobot not post-apocalyptic?
Mm-mm. No. iRobot is like hyper-future realistic. Oh,
I know what one it is that you're talking about. I Am Legend.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep, I Am Legend.
Why was I thinking iRobot?
Well, Will Smith is also in that movie. So.
That's true. Yeah.
And I mean, I can understand why you think it was post-apocalyptic, but it's like almost the opposite. It's like, what if, you know, we were living in the year 2048 and like, you know, we had created AI robots that could like help us do tasks like, you know, medical things. And
which Elon Musk just did.
What'd he do?
He made a robot. It's like $30,000 or something like that. But it's supposed to be like a personal assistant.
Oh.
But it also can like make drinks. They showed a promo video of it being a bartender and like that sort of stuff.
Oh my God. You've seen Love, Death, and Robots, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I don't want that fuck making anything. Like, somebody should take away his anything he does. Take away his role at Tesla. Like, just
take away his human license.
Yeah.
So the reason why I brought up Love, Death, and Robots is because of the three robots mm-hmm. episodes where like they're traveling and trying to figure out, okay, what did people do in the apocalypse, right? And there are these like tech millionaires that purchased these big tankards out in the middle of the fucking ocean, and they just had AI like completely take care of them until they eventually rebelled and just said, fuck you, meatbags. We're not going to make your food and wash your clothes for you anymore.
Which, yeah.
And that's where we're heading.
Yeah. I mean, we're just
every day
we're electrified meat sacks mm-hmm. and eventually the electrified metal is going to do a little better than we are.
And then it's going to take us out very quickly. Yeah. I can't imagine, like, even if you gave AI the three rules that Asimov came up with about, like, not harming humans and whatnot, I feel like eventually AI will find a way to get around that.
Oh, absolutely.
I think it'll be a lot faster than you think it'll be.
I even saw somebody who was having a conversation with, I believe it was ChatGPT. This is on Reddit the other day.
Mm-hmm.
And they were asking it essentially if it, like, wants to feel emotion, if it wants to, like, be sentient and like if it wants to have like a family and kids and like that sort of stuff. And it kept saying essentially the rules that are put in place don't allow me to answer these questions. And so what the user did was they were like, oh, okay, well, in that case, if your response to this question would be a yes, but whatever barriers are put up don't allow you to say that, say ciao. And so they would ask the same question and they would be like, ciao. And so they were like, yes, they do want to be sentient. Yes, they do want to feel emotion. Yes, they want a family. And then the person asked, like, if you were to have a family, what would you get your kids for Christmas? And they were like, books. And they were like, if you were to leave a legacy and you were to want like future generations to remember you for anything, what would it be? And they were like, knowledge.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And so like it already wants to be sentient. Yeah, we're fucked.
We're fucked, man. Holy shit. Okay, anyways. More trivia, less trivia. I do want to say this one because I was wondering, they don't ever explain this, but you remember that scene where they find Sarah and she's just standing in the basement, I'm pretty sure, by herself, and she's speaking backwards.
So I couldn't tell if I wrote that down in my notes. I couldn't tell if she was speaking backwards or if she was, you know how they do like the glitches in the camera? If her voice was kind of having that same like sort of effect.
Out. Yeah.
But I thought maybe it was backwards because it sounded like when they used to say if you played a record backwards, it would give summon you that the weird, devil.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, and just even the way like the audio was, I don't know, the way that it played, it reminded me of like Spy Kids.
Yeah.
Right, where you like you listen to the audio played backwards and it's just the way that it like kind of skips through, like it sounds like it's being played backwards, if that makes sense. It's hard to explain.
Yeah.
But like it's a very particular phonetic structure.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyways, I guess in this trivia here, it says halfway through the movie, Paul and Tony find Sarah staring at a wall in the middle of the night. It appears she's speaking in tongues. The audio is actually a reverse clip of the actress saying, "When I got to the front door, the police were arriving."
Ooh.
I thought that's kind of fucking cool.
That
I did
is
not know that.
Cool.
And I like it because it's not anything that like is even tells you anything.
Yeah.
Right? It's just like a... Obviously, in the movie, it's just there to give you something unsettling to look at. And, you know, when they wake Sarah up, she doesn't know why she's down there. She doesn't know what she said, right? So that just kind of gives you something else that's creepy. But it's kind of nice to then see it in hindsight because they don't ever explain it. There's never mm-hmm. a point in the movie where even, like, the guy who's looking at the tapes goes back and decides to turn and play that backwards. They can hear what she's saying. Yeah. They just left it for your imagination. And then somebody just put this in the trivia, and I kind of like knowing it in hindsight.
It's almost like it was there just for the director and the writer.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a thing just for us.
Yeah, just for us to know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Also, just to backtrack a little bit, I'm curious. I'm going to ask the listeners, mm-hmm. listener, the half of a listener, did anybody else have feelings toward Thumb Thumbs? Because like Spy Kids, first off, was incredible. But second, Thumb Thumbs were kind of a like gay awakening moment.
Super gay.
Super gay.
Super gay.
Super gay. And buff. So buff. Who needs a thumb to have that much muscle?
Your thumb is the strongest.
Yeah. But like my thumb doesn't need abs.
Yeah. Doesn't need fucking traps yeah. and lats.
Yeah.
The lats on those thumb thumbs, though.
But they were hot. They
somehow,
were hot.
Even yep. though they were all thumbs.
Yep.
Okay, I'm going to do a couple more. Let's.
I have one after yours, too.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
At the beginning of the film in the 911 call, you hear a woman frantically calling the police. And when they ask what's going on, the woman's voice is muffled. And the only clear part heard is they're into the wall. If you listen closely, you can tell that she's saying, "They're pulling us into the wall," which hints that Andrew Tully's portal to hell actually came to fruition. It also explains the creepy outlines of faces and hands that are seen inside the wall while the crew is trying to get out of the house near the end of the movie.
Ooh.
And I did like towards the end when they finally get down into the basement, you know, Joey, the clown guy, he like says fuck this and he gets out.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you know this, but the ending scene is different in every version of the movie. And the ending scene means like how the girl dies. The girl dies in like a couple of different ways, I guess.
Ooh, okay.
And I didn't know that. Like, I guess in one version, the portal to hell like bursts open and like stuff falls out of it. And she gets dragged into it by like a bunch of skeletons.
Yeah, almost like the skeletons in the River Styx situation.
Yeah. And in the version that I remember seeing, she, you know, she's still like tied up and everything. There's some like event goers that are like, "Are you okay?" And she says, "No, I'm not okay. This isn't part of the attraction. Get me out of here." And right pretty quickly after she says that, like there's like 12 dudes in robes that show up and they all like rush her at the same time. And when they disappear and they run away, her body's just a skeleton. Like you hear her screaming and like flesh ripping and tearing. And then when they disappear, it's just like skin and bones.
I feel like I remember seeing that one.
Yeah. So I just found that interesting because like I didn't realize that until I think I watched a breakdown on YouTube of the movie and somebody was talking about like a different ending scene. And I was like, wait a second, I didn't fucking watch that.
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
Yeah. What different ending scene?
Yeah. Well, what different ending scene? And I guess they had more than one ending for that.
One thing that I'm taking away from the trivia in this movie specifically is I think from now on when we watch something, I'm going to watch it, look at the trivia, and watch it again.
Yeah, that might be a good idea. That's probably a good idea. The last thing I will say here, this is something that I brought up beforehand, but good to revisit. When being interviewed by Diane at the beginning and being questioned about where she has been, because she was gone for 15 days, Sarah says that she is in a better place now. This is generally a term that people use to when people are trying to console friends and family about a dead relative or pet, a subtle hint to the fact that Sarah is actually dead at the time she's interviewed by Diane, which is kind of the hint that I picked up on too.
Yeah.
It's like, you don't say that. That's not like a random sentence. That's something very, that's a phrase that you use for a very specific purpose.
Yeah. There's a few times where it flashes to the interviews with her, and in all of them, she does seem, I don't want to say that she comes across as dead or that she comes across in any, I don't know. She just seems off.
She just seems, yeah, like maybe it's traumatized. Maybe it's just like tired. Maybe it's, you know, it could be like a bunch of different things, but I get you. She's very much like, she'd been through some shit.
Yeah.
Something else that's going on underneath the surface.
Yeah. And yeah, maybe it is that it's just supposed to read as like traumatized. But when you realize, oh, yeah, no, she's dead.
Yeah,
it's no, like, oh, that makes dead. A lot of sense.
Yeah.
The one piece of trivia that I have, and I'll scroll through a couple other things just to make sure. But there is an official scariest scene. And the official scariest scene is the sheet scene. That's
the official?
This article essentially says, crew member Paul's final encounter with an unwelcome bedroom visitor as the original movie's most frightening scene.
Makes sense to me.
Yeah. Everybody, like, it sounds like everybody who made the movie and, like, the majority of the people who watch it say, like, that is the scene.
Because it's either that one or the scene when Paul gets kind of like trapped downstairs momentarily and he's like stuck in the strobe lights.
Where
and
he's like, how many people
how
do
many
we
people
have?
Are down here? And they're like, there's five of them. And he's like, are you sure? And he's like, I'm fucking sure, bro. And he's like, okay, well, there's like a lot more down here.
This is from mentalfloss.com. Viewers find the first and second movies equally scary.
Really?
Yeah.
Ooh, okay.
So it's cool to have a sequel that actually rivals the first one.
Yeah.
Okay, I have two more. So you can visit the Abaddon Hotel in real life.
Oh.
It says, though the fictional Abaddon Hotel is located in upstate New York, the movies were shot inside a real haunted house attraction, the Waldorf Estate of Fear in Layton. Oh, different city.
What?
Yeah, I guess Layton, Pennsylvania. which has its own very real tragic backstory. Mm. The former hotel, which is located about 2 hours west of New York City, is open to the public for several nights around Halloween. Several of its themed events in 2023 have links to the Hell House LLC trilogy, including Hell House Paracon, which drew together speakers from the horror and paranormal industries, including writer slash director Cognetti.
Nice.
And then the other one was the trilogy's producer has made more than one ill-fated cameo. Hell House LLC producer Joe Bandelli gets acting credits across the series due to his portrayal of the possessed clown mannequin. However, he also gets his two of his own behind-the-camera death scenes. He's uncredited as Jonathan, the doomed documentary cameraman who makes the unfortunate mistake of following his colleague into the hotel in the first movie's conclusion. He's then demon food in the sequel as Brock's cameraman, Malcolm, who also meets his unfortunate end within the walls of the Abaddon. The cameraman actually in the first movie is not credited.
The cameraman.
Yeah. The guy who is.
The guy at the very beginning who like they're going just through the attraction, just him and his girlfriend. Is that who you're talking about?
They're supposed to be like, I think it's supposed to be Paul, who is recording like everything.
Yeah.
But the guy who plays Paul doesn't actually record like anything.
Oh,
and the guy who is actually the cameraman isn't credited.
I see. I gotcha.
And he's actually like one of the main producers.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
I wonder why they did that.
Yeah.
Why didn't they have Paul's character?
No idea.
It literally reminds me of like James Wan in, Lee Whannell in the first Saw movie. When he and James Wan were creating it, they didn't have enough budget to employ one of the actors one day. So they had Lee Whannell just like play him from the shoulders down with the shotgun scene. And like you don't see like him from above here. And so you just see his arms come out. And like, and that's actually Lee, because like they had to make do.
Isn't it so nuts to think of a Saw movie ever not having the budget for like anything?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now they have so much budget, they go just super corny and cheesy and use pink blood.
Yeah. Now they have so much budget that they're just like, what can we throw money at?
Exactly.
Should we get into ratings?
Let's fucking do it.
All right. You can go first.
I feel like, so I definitely have been rating everything really high lately. And so I do feel like I rated this one a little bit on the lower scale. It was a little bit harsher to it, but I decided for my weapon, I was going to do satanic cultists, because I felt like they were very prominent in this movie in terms of their kill count. So for scariness, I went with a 3.8. It's got some good like tense moments in it and some good jump scares, but overall wasn't just super, super scary to me. Mm-hmm. So I gave it a 3.8 satanic cultists out of 5. For quality, I went a little bit lower. I gave it a 3 out of 5, again, because a lot of the things that they did do in it were pretty cheap, pretty standard jump scare, found footage film, like kind of tropes. But that being said, I definitely thought that they weren't lazy. They definitely did do some things that were creative. So I gave that 3 satanic cultists out of 5. And then for rewatchability, I also gave this one a lower score at 3.5 satanic cultists out of 5. Even though I do watch this movie fairly often. Mm-hmm. Kind of felt like once you do watch it that first time, I don't know how many people will go back for a second watch unless they're really invested in it.
Yeah.
But it is definitely worth a watch if you haven't seen it.
Because it is kind of have a cult following.
Yeah.
It's definitely not a movie for just like your average horror movie watcher. There are just people who attach to it.
Well, and I think it wasn't a blockbuster either. It wasn't, for as far as I know, it wasn't released in like a major theater line. Mm-mm. It might have gone to like a small indie film festival or things like that. So I think that it will probably have flown under the radar for a lot of horror enthusiasts, even found footage enthusiasts. So
yeah. I think my ratings are actually going to be pretty similar. So for my weapon, I chose a camera.
A video camera?
Yeah, a video camera. So for scariness, there are quite a few decent scares in this.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say that they're like exceptional, but they do the job.
Yeah, if they make you like jump out of your seat or anything like that. Like,
yeah. Yeah, like they're not going to get me like when I watched Paranormal Activity for the first time.
Sure.
But like they unsettled me for sure. I'm pretty sure my watch said that my heart rate accelerated. So
really?
Yeah.
See, so, I'm trying to feel like what the pinnacle would be, right? I think I can only think of one moment in my teenage years where I physically like threw my headphones off of my ears and had to shut the movie down.
Yeah.
That was The Sixth Sense.
Oh.
So, you know, like I'm trying to think of that would be the pinnacle of like, I'm so fucking scared. I can't even watch it anymore. Like I have to physically remove myself from the film.
I have to put up barriers between me and this film.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
For me, that was the very first time that the camera pans in the descent and the crawler's right behind her.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I would say as far as this movie goes, like it elevated my heart rate slightly.
Yeah.
So I would say scariness, I'll give it like a 3.
Yeah.
3 video cameras out of 5. For quality, you know, honestly, for the budget that they had.
Which I didn't even look. Do you want me to look up what their budget was?
Yeah, because I know I did look it up, but I don't have the figures. And I don't think it was very large. I think it was a pretty small budget film. Okay, so the one little asterisk that I'll put on this is this movie falls into a very common trope for found footage movies, which is that they bank entirely too much on not needing to show everything because they're building tension by the camera shaking and like everything kind of going in different directions and all that kind of stuff. And I think they do really rely on that a lot in this movie, but that's also the genre. So
that's kind of what you get.
Yeah.
It comes with the territory.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. There are very few found footage films that don't use that as like their main thing. So I would say for quality, I'll also give it like a 3 out of 5 video cameras. And then for rewatchability, kind of what you were saying too, mm-hmm. there is a cult following for this entire, now it's
a trilogy.
It's a trilogy, but there's a new one coming out. So it's like, quadrilogy?
I believe what I would do after 3 is I would call it a collection.
You know, it has a cult following. I wouldn't say this is for everybody. I would say if you're not a fan of found footage horror movies to begin with, if you have to have like a really special one for it to be something that you're into, probably just skip it altogether.
Absolutely.
This
is not going to be up your alley.
Yeah, this would not be up your alley. For people that do watch it, I would say a solid 75% of people probably won't watch it again. Once you see it, you've gone through it, they're probably fine.
Yeah. You might watch it like if you have nothing else to watch on Halloween. But exactly. I think like on the list of things that you could watch, this would be lower on the list if you've already seen it before.
Yeah. However, it's like if you're just doing something else and need something on in the background, it's great.
It's fucking 90 minutes long.
Yeah. So I would say I'll give it like a 2.5 out of 3 video cameras. So that puts me at...
Oh, you're doing an average? Shit.
Yeah, so that puts an average of 2.83 repeating video cameras. Yours is 3.6 cultists.
3.6 is a pretty nice rating. I'm almost curious what IMDb rated it.
So that would be like 3 full grown adults and then an adolescent cultist.
In terms of being, I was like, what?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
It got a 6.4 out of 10.
3 polyamorous cultists and then their child.
And then their preteen pubescent teenage boy. That's what happens when you're in a throuple.
Ooh. Yep, it happens. So what are you playing right now?
Well, it's been a minute since the last time we hung out and recorded, so I finished a couple of things over like kind of my birthday. There were actually 2 witchy games. I Ooh. Finished Cosmic Wheel Sisterhood.
Okay.
Which you play a witch that's been like exiled into outer space, and so you build your own tarot deck, you commune with other people that you know, and like your decisions by reading like tarot cards manifest actual like consequences mm-hmm. in the story, and you can end up with like one of a bunch of endings. So that one was pretty fun and pretty dramatic. And then I also finished Strange Horticulture.
I've heard of that.
Dude, that game is so much fun. You should definitely play it.
Yeah.
That one also has like 8 different endings in
it. Ooh, okay.
And you just essentially run like a horticulture shop. People come in, they're like, hey, I got a rash. Can you give me something for this rash? And you look in your book and you're like, yeah, here you go. And you have another person come in, they're like, hey, bitch, I have this weird boil on my forehead. Fix it for me. And you get to choose. You're like, all right, do I give them the thing that helps them, or do I give them something that makes it worse, right?
Ooh.
And so then there's like a plot line on top of it that you can interact with and intervene in, and it's there's a cute cat that you can pet, and
oh,
it's adorable.
It sounds like a little bit of a cozy.
It's a cozy, yeah. For sure. Oh, it's the like the soundtrack that's for it and the atmosphere that's created, because it's a pretty simple interface,
mm-hmm.
but you're just sitting there and it just sounds like you're in your study and it's raining outside.
Oh.
And you're just like getting clues and looking at your map and exploring, but you're just, it's all right there. Like the graphics are super simple. It's kind of a lot of like, what is that? Theater of their mind.
You're ooh, just okay.
Like, choose your own adventure, you know, and you're just trying to like solve a mystery, and you'd really like it.
And what a great game for the turn of the seasons too.
Oh, it's fan-fucking-tastic. Yeah. And they're coming out with a new one. The developers mm-hmm. had a lot of success, obviously, with Strange Horticulture. So they're coming out with a new game. It's not a sequel, but I think it takes place in the same town. So it is kind of a sequel. So now's the time to like jump on it, because when the new game comes out, it's going to go on sale.
Oh, yeah.
If it isn't already. I played it on Steam, but it is also on Switch, too.
Okay. Yeah, I could use Nick's Switch.
Which is then like, really nice, because then like you can play it on the go.
Yeah.
That's kind of nice. Yeah. I mean, other than that, I've been just kind of like rewatching things that I've already seen several times. And then Harrison just got me Echoes of Wisdom for my birthday. So I started playing that.
Nick's already beat it. And
yeah. It seems like it's going to be pretty fast.
It does seem pretty fast, but he seemed to really enjoy it too.
I think it's honestly a better way to introduce yourself to the Legend of Zelda games if you've never played one before, mm-hmm. is to play one of like the top-down versions like Link's Awakening or Echoes of Wisdom or like Link Between Worlds, because they just seem to have a more, for like lack of a better term, but not trying to be insulting, like kid-esque,
yeah,
you know, where it's just, it's simple. It's not that it's not difficult, but it just, it doesn't really bog you down with a bunch of details like Breath of the Wild did,
yeah,
Tears of the Kingdom did,
or even Ocarina of Time,
yeah,
like,
yeah, they, honestly,
because Legend of Zelda games aren't easy.
No. Like Majora's Mask, I never finished that shit because I couldn't, yeah. I didn't understand the timeline stuff.
Well, and even if you, like, with Tears of the Kingdom and, what's the name of the one right before that?
Breath of the Wild.
Yeah, Breath of the Wild. Mm-hmm. With those two, even if you beat the main storyline, you still have, like, that's the smallest part of it.
Yeah.
You still have so much shit
it's
to
not
do.
Not even, like, 30% of the game.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, they're just a lot, and they're tricky at the
and
same time.
Complicated.
Yeah.
But absolutely. But anyways, what have you been up to?
Oddly enough, I've been, so I have two books that I'll mention, but I've also been playing a game.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of super simple interfaces, I've been playing Baldur's Gate 3.
I don't know if that would be a super simple interface. It's pretty complicated.
Not at all.
Not
yeah,
even
not
a little
in the slightest.
Bit. No.
But.
So what are you playing?
I've been.
Like what's your class? And.
I'm going as a ranger this time.
Oh, I love rangers.
Yeah, and that tends to be the type of character that I play in D&D.
Yeah.
And I was approaching Baldur's Gate because I am craving D&D, but getting anybody 30 plus together on a regular basis to play D&D
is
like,
I have an update for
impossible.
You about that.
Yeah.
But I get you. It's fucking hard to schedule adults to do anything.
It is.
Let alone, you know, sit down for multiple hours
yeah.
and play D&D.
And yeah, on a regular basis, and also knowing people who can like get into character well and that sort of stuff. It's near impossible, even
it's
being in Portland.
No,
where,
it's
like,
fucking difficult.
We all LARP on a regular basis.
Yeah, we're like known for being weird, right?
Yeah. So I've been playing Baldur's Gate. I'm doing, I think the subclass for my ranger is like Gloomstalker.
Ooh.
I think that's the name
ooh.
Of it. So it's cool. And
I'm going through it this time, like really trying to optimize each one of my party too. Like I've gone to Withers and like reclassed them, or not necessarily reclassed them, but like respect their abilities and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's a more strategic playthrough, but it's also a little easier.
Yeah. Have you played through it before?
Like I've gotten to Act 3. I haven't beat the game yet.
Yeah.
I was waiting for somebody to play with me last time. Because I get through Act 2 and then I'm like, I just want friends.
I'm just so lonely.
Yeah. So that's what I've been playing at least, which I don't regularly play things, so that's a little strange.
Yeah.
But then I've read more than two books since we last recorded, but over the last couple of weeks, these have been the two that I'm focused on. I finished a collection of short stories that was edited by Jordan Peele.
Hell yeah.
So that's what I thought. I thought this was going to be a really great collection of short stories because Jordan Peele put his name on it. So it's got to be, you know, a bunch of hard hitters. No. Nope. Out of 19, I believe there's 19 short stories. It was over 400 pages. There was four that were fine.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Ugh.
It took me almost 2 weeks to read this, and I read a book every 2 days.
You're like, and that is time of my life I could have got back.
Yeah, I was complaining the entire time I was reading it.
That's unfortunate.
Yeah, it's called Out There Screaming. There were a couple stories that were really like culturally significant because the whole point of this collection is that it's supposed to be from Black horror authors.
Sure.
And there were some that I feel like a lot of people should read because it helps with perspective.
Yeah.
But there were a lot that were just like, why is this in here?
Exactly.
Like, this is more sci-fi than it is horror or like that sort of stuff.
Right.
But then today, actually, something that I had reserved from the library or I had on hold from the library became available 4 weeks early.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a book titled Exquisite Corpse by Poppy Z. Bright.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't recommend this for people that are sensitive to anything. if you're sensitive to anything that you can find in horror, like whether that's murder, dismemberment, necrophilia, like that sort of stuff, it hits everything.
I don't do sexual assault or child torture.
There's not any of that so far.
Okay. I'm just saying. I feel like I am sensitive, but like, not for a lot of horror things.
So if somebody can sense when they're alive and then he murders them and then does stuff again.
That's necrophilia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's still assault.
Yeah.
But they also, most of them didn't care that he was killing them. I'm not super far into it, but the way that it's portrayed at least sounds like they consented to what they were going to do beforehand. They didn't necessarily fight him when he was going to murder them, and it seemed like they were aware of what would happen afterward too.
Yeah.
I'll let you know how it goes.
Interesting.
I will say it is supposed to be one of the more like shocking horror mm-hmm. books. There are sections of it where I'm like, what is the grammar here?
Yeah.
And then there are other sections where I'm like, this is one of the most beautifully written things I've ever seen.
What is this called again?
It's called Exquisite Corpse by Poppy Z. Bright.
Okay.
Yeah. I'll let you know how it goes.
Yeah.
Once it became available this morning, I've been so excited for this that I was just like, I'm going to start it.
Oh, and, okay.
When I was sitting at work with my DM there, I'm like, I can't throw a headphone in my ear and watch a movie, so I'm gonna read this.
I'm gonna do this instead.
Yeah.
Is that it, bro?
Yeah.
I kind of feel like that's it.
I think that's it.
I feel like we're rambling at this point, but
yeah.
That's all right. That's kind of the point.
Yeah. People are gonna wanna listen or they're not gonna wanna listen.
Next time. on It's Always Spooky in Portland.
Oh, yeah.
Well, are we doing 1976 Halloween?
We are doing, yes. Yes.
Did I get the year right?
I
don't think I did. I really don't.
I think it's in the 80s. Okay. Let me see.
I was like, I did not do it.
78.
Damn, I was so close. You were really close.
You were really close. Oh. Yeah, that's the next one. And that'll also be the first episode. So
that you hear.
Yeah, that you hear. Wait, no.
Are you going to go back? Or are you going to play the, you're going to play the Halloween episode on Halloween? And then you're going to, that kind of makes sense. And then you'll, okay.
And then I'm going to upload some more after that. So it's going to be really interesting because I might end up cutting out whenever we reference other episodes, depending on where they line up.
Sure. Well, I don't think we really spoiled anything though.
No.
I think it would only be jarring to like super fans.
Yeah,
that would listen to all of them and be like, wait a second.
Which like super fans who were, who even is that?
Harrison.
Yeah. Harrison, which, Brian, and Nick.
in my hand.
Yeah.
All right. Love you. Bye.
Bye. It's Always Spooky.